you're structured, so you're not just talking to yourself. Then you've got to actually listen to other people. Feedback, and I'm a three, so I get it. My feedback for three is just like catnip. Man, we love to get feedback, even if it's negative feedback, because we tell ourselves, well, it'll make me better. Like, I'll be better. I'll grow. I'll be better. So we just want feedback. Some of that has to do with knowing what church you're in. Churches, too, typically, churches are organisms. And because that's the truth, your church probably has an Enneagram style.
Hey, welcome to this episode of the Pastor's Roundtable Podcast, where we give practical roadmaps for rising leaders to thrive in life and leadership. Today, I'm speaking with Sean Palmer, who is the teaching pastor, he's a speaker, executive coach, and the author of a couple of books, 40 Days of Being a Three. And the one we're going to be talking about, diving in today, is Speaking by the Numbers. Great communicator. And this book is about communication. And as rising leaders, so many of us are communicating on a daily basis to leaders, to students, to parents. And so great conversation. Hey, Sean, thanks for jumping in, and excited to jump in today.
Well, thanks, Ryan. I'm excited to be here, excited to have this conversation, and always excited to talk about being a tool for ministry and life. So glad that you're having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so good, man. So, hey, why don't you just give us a little bit of your backstory, a little bit of your ministry journey, and we can kind of take it from there.
Well, I'm pretty old now, so the ministry journey story just gets longer and longer. The quick version is I grew up in the church in Mississippi and Georgia as a kid. I'm a Church of Christ kid, raising, went to Abilene Christian University, did undergraduate degree there, and youth and family ministry, so a lot of people went to work as a student minister. Over time, I became more interested in communication and preaching, went back to school while I was working vocationally to study analytics, did that. Moved around a couple of times in Houston, had a church here, then our family went to California. We were there for 3 years, came back to Texas to be closer to family and friends, and started on this wonderful little church in Central Texas. For the last 6 years, and the teaching pastor here back in Houston at Ecclesia Houston, which was founded a little bit over 20 years ago by my friend Chris C. Chris is still our lead pastor. We have been friends almost since the founding of Ecclesia. And when they were going multi-site, multi-site church in the country, that we were literally giving the first opportunity to say, like, can you do something with this? And so we're committed to a version of incarnational living. In-person preaching really matters. And so when we were making that transition as a church, he gave me a call on a Tuesday night and said, hey, I need to come down here and be teaching pastor with me, carry the teaching load. So we've done that. We've worked this with other properties. So we have three campuses now. And that's what I do. Pretty much live in the world of like writing and speaking. It's a world of words. I'm fortunate enough to be in a church that me to handle that domain and to be the primary guider in the preaching and teaching diet. But we are surrounded by an incredible ministry. So that's me in a nutshell. I've been able to write and speak a lot in that.
Yeah. So incarnational living, that's such a good lane, but as that grows, right, as the church has grown, I'm sure that's had to kind of morph and change. Talk about that a little bit, how you've kept that as a primary focus, but as the church grows, it can be kind of a struggle, I'm sure.
It is, and a lot of that is accessibility. So I think I heard Caitlin Beatty describe celebrity as this idea of influence with proximity. And one of the things that we are trying to center on is being people who are guiding your church, full-time vocation is to pay attention to God and the church. And those are people that you can actually walk up to. You can schedule a meeting. You can send a text. You can go to their house. They will come to you. To close the gap between the folks you see on stage, which churches, especially over the last 30 years, have become more and more and more stage-centered and less table-centered. And we want to be a place where the table is still central. You can know us. You can know kids. You can know other people on staff. So you can know their partner. You can know their kids. You get to know their stories. And we want to know yours. And if you can't do that, and this is not, there are different strategies for different churches at different seasons in their life. For us, we feel like there's something plastic about the idea of seeing someone on a screen that you can't come up to after worship and say, this really blessed me, or this thing that you're talking about, the real struggle for me. For one, as a communicator, don't know how I would be able to communicate and preach in the sphere of I want to know where people are. So there are ways to do that in smaller churches, in churches that are even larger than ours. There's a lot of churches that are that different churches have to go back on different ways. There is a piece of that. So pushing against this culture of celebrity, pushing against culture of ego, of kingdom building. Like, we're only interested in one kingdom, that's God's kingdom, individual kingdoms. So those are ways that we have tried to address those problems. I know that there are other attempts in other places to be equally faithful with what we've given.
Yeah, so good. Well, Sean, I first came across you with the book 40 Days of Being a Three. And obviously, this is all about the Enneagram and specifically being a type three. And so let's just kind of go back a little bit, maybe just give, for those that aren't totally familiar with the Enneagram, just give us kind of a short snap look at kind of what the Enneagram is.
So, for those who are unfamiliar, Enneagram is an ancient personality typing system. And I get lots of questions of where did it come from? I kind of go and pull the book off the origin of the Enneagram. And the answer to that is that no one really sees shades of it through history. It has come through many contemplative strains of lots of different religions. And is doing some work with the recent origins of the Enneagram. It hasn't been fully released yet. I'm anxious to see it and watch it and see what he comes up with. But the best way to think about the Enneagram is a type of personality wisdom. And so, just like if you're opening up the book for Psalms, for Job, those are fundamental wisdom literature, but also all three get wisdom from different directions. If you open up Proverbs, you get a very if-then world. Like, if you do this, then this will happen. Psalms works a different way. And then Job comes and says, enters into wisdom literature and says, Job's friends are the ones who show up and say, like, we're reading the world through an if-then lens. The book of Job exists partially to teach us it's not always if then. And so what we learn when we look at the great wisdom tradition in the scripture is that wisdom works a lot of different ways. And the key to discerning wisdom, and you find this in books like Ecclesiastes, the key to discerning wisdom is, does it work? Mm-hmm. Not whether it can be traced back, and you can say, you know, like a history class, where you say, landed on the moon this date, or Columbus discovered America this year. That's interesting and noteworthy. It's ancient. But wisdom doesn't work that way. Wisdom asks the question, when applied to, does it work? or when we see life through this lens, does that make sense of our spirit, true to our spirit? And that's the way that wisdom has always worked. So one of the things that my family has been very interested in over the last 4 to 5 years is reading the First Testament, the Old Testament, and hearing the voices of ancient and contemporary rabbis and teachers, because they ask different questions of the text to get different textures and contours. And so what we want to ask with all things, this is a contextual experience, like, does it ring true to the deepest truths that we know? And does it ring true to our experience of ourselves in the world? And for me, the Enneagram really helps us answer the 4 big questions of life, which is, the Enneagram helps us answer how we perceive the world, how we connect to others, how we solve problems, and how we see the world, how we connect to others, how we solve problems, and how we get what we want. And if you could know that about yourself, to know those 4 things, how we perceive the world, solve problems, how we connect to others, it gives you a whole space to explore your world and the world around you. And I think that's the utility of the Enneagram, considering the top 3 or 2. And, you know, there are plenty of personality systems that help us do that. Fundamentally, what the Enneagram is trying to do.
Yeah, so why do you feel like the Enneagram is so helpful for ministry leaders? I know before we even started recording, you kind of talked about how you've kind of integrated it into some of the practices you're using there, even at your church. So why do you feel like it's so important for ministry leaders?
What's important to me for ministry life is that the Enneagram helps us identify and name where our motivations are. And that's where people actually live. Where other personality systems and theory can talk a lot about behavior. The Enneagram talks about motivations. So 2 people who are different can have the same behavior, but perform those behaviors for really different reasons. And once you know for yourself, for instance, why this matters to you so much, why motivations are structured in such a way, why your personality is structured in such a way, then I can kind of move, after knowing, to either adapting or changing or nurturing those motivations. So if you say to me, like, Myers-Briggs question, there is a question to it. You go to a party. Are you more comfortable being in the center of the party where things are happening, or on the outskirts of the party, having one-on-one conversation with someone? Well, it depends on the party. Well, like, if it's my birthday party, I want to be in the center because all of those people, presumably, I know. And I also know that all those people came to celebrate my birthday party. I'm also from the center, was raised in the center. And to talk to one person in the corner during my birthday party is just rude. I wouldn't want to do that. Have a certain motivation in that moment that is about my connection with other people. If it's a party of a spouse, of a coworker, and there's only one other person that I know at the party, and we spend an extended amount of time in the corner talking, that's probably okay. We'll never see these people again. So behavior doesn't tell us all that much. Motivation tells us a whole lot. And when you know where are these people in the church who are connected to? Where are there other people who are connected to? What are their tasks that they want to do and that they don't want to do? Why do I feel that, like, when I'm called upon to teach in a public setting. This is a very common issue for people in ministry. And there's something that excites me about that, and I want to do it. Like, why do I want to do that? Like, do I want to preach because, like, there is this truly spiritual burning in attention? But if I like attention and I get it, does that mean that I'm good at this, or it means that I'm getting my ego stroked, or part of my personality structure that's being nurtured? And what happens if I really want the attention, and then I'm very good at it, and someone points out to me that I'm very good? How do I then feel about that person or community? And all of that, behavior can't tell you all. But as you explore the ingrams, especially once you get coffee shop, you begin to explore a deeper what it means, because it is much more than just someone knowing their number. Most people who think they know the Enneagram don't know that there's more to it than knowing your number.
Yeah, and that's kind of the big thing, right? There's so many social media, memes out there with, a 3 wants this for Christmas and an 8 wants this for Christmas. A lot of us, we kind of feel like we know quite a bit of those kind of social things, but I love what you're saying about going deeper. And so, as a younger leader, we're working with volunteers. Do you feel like there's maybe some tips on kind of helping us interact with our volunteers in through the lens of the Enneagram? I mean, is that like, hey, this type might work better in this type of volunteer capacity or this, or is it kind of just how to help keep them motivated? How would you say we can infuse this into our volunteers?
Oh yeah, totally. Because obviously the more you can be to them on their journey. So one of the dangers, Ryan, of the Enneagram is when it becomes a weapon to use against other people. So the Enneagram is a weapon when used against others or on others. It is a tool when used for yourself. So the first step in ministry is to know yourself well. You're working with people, and so you're going to run up against things. So let's say that you've got a volunteer who for you feels intransigent. Like they always have something negative to say, no matter what you're trying to do, trying to push forward, or it could be a coworker, fellow staff member. You come into the meeting, you've got something you want to roll out that you're super excited about. And what they start doing is like questioning it to death. Well, what about this? And what about this? And is this going to work? Those things are necessary to run something. There are certain Enneagram who interpret that kind of questioning, not as question, but as question. And so they feel that they are being called incompetent, or their position is being threatened. And you've got a person over here who, because of their personality structure, let's just say that they're a 6 on the Enneagram. The more you're able to answer their questions, the more secure they feel about the direction that this is headed. And so they're not asking the question and being negative about the idea. They're asking the question because they are coming at it to help me feel secure about this. And so one of the key things about the Enneagram is one of the things that is the centerpiece is intelligence. And so inside the Enneagram, the teaching is that we all have 3 intelligence centers, and those intelligence centers thinking, feeling, and doing. And the reality is we all think, we all feel, and we all do. So imagine yourself like a 3-legged stool. But very early in experience, one of those intelligence centers is wounded. And what we say to ourselves is, I'll never try that again. Either in the family of origin or with a primary caregiver, I got the message that intelligence center was not going to be successful. So we have over then relied on the other 2 to get us through life. And if you live long enough, you will hit a wall where you realize that relying on 2 intelligence centers is not enough to get you through. So what happens is one of those intentions, and this happens for everyone, one of those becomes done. And that's the way that you pretty much move through the world. And one of those becomes repressed and you never use it. Imagine going and talking to your volunteers. You've got a room full of volunteers. And you've got a great idea that you think the data will lay this out needs to be this way. Because let's say you're thinking dumb. You're thinking dumb. You're kind of lying on the laughing. And then you realize you're getting more pushback than you anticipated. That might be because everyone in the room is not thinking dumb. Some of them are thinking repressed. And, you know, one of the things I do in the book is I define what thinking, feeling, and doing. Because some folks get very upset when they realize that they are repressed in one of those. So ones, twos, and sixes. Thinking repressed. So my wife was a woman. And when she discovered that she was thinking repressed, said, that can't possibly be true. I think, which is absolutely true. And so one of the ways to think about your repression is the thing that costs you more energy. It's not that you don't do it. It just costs you more energy to do it. So she goes, she leaves work every day. She's teaching day, she's making decisions all day. She comes home, and that intelligence in her, because she's thinking repressed, is exhausted. So, what does she do when she gets home? She asks me about everything. She wants me to make all of the decisions. And for her, this is moving toward, because one, two, and six is moved toward. There are multiple ways to talk about this. So, you've got three centers. You've got three numbers, one, twos, and sixes, who are thinking repressed. You've got three sevens and eights who are feeling repressed. And you've got four sevens and eights who are doing repressed. Some folks are fours or fives or eights. They work really all day. They're doing stuff all day that costs them so much energy. So when it comes to working with staff, when it comes to working with volunteers, one of the places we need to be careful with is leveling communication so that everyone is communicated with in a way that feels native to them and in a way that feels like they have to do a little bit of work to get there. Because what we want total is the three-legged stool to come into balance. They can never come into balance if people are never asked to use their room. So we have to do a little bit of that, but we also have to say, when someone comes to me, just a very vivid experience of this with our staff this week, and it is just all feelings. Because I'm a three, I'm feeling repressed, so I'm also feeling dominant. So feel what they're feeling, and get what they're feeling. I just don't think it matters what you feel. So when people say, I just feel run down, I was like, well, that's great. We've got work to do. Feelings aren't, like, let's get on with the work. And so I need people in my work to help me sit with feelings. Other people need folks to make them think and ask questions. Other folks need people to get up and do something. And just mill around doing lots of things that don't happen to anyone. So those are some of the ways in ministry. And the sooner you know that, the better you can, especially when you're younger in ministry. So one of the things is, at this point, I guess I would just say, I've been in full-time vocational ministry for 26 years. And here's what I knew I didn't as a young pastor. In terms of life experience. When I was in student ministry, there was nothing that I could say that would authority to what I was saying to parents who had raised two, three, five kids. And here I am with, an 18-month But with an understanding of who they were rather than what I knew, I'd be much more successful. Because the reality of ministry, I don't know if people say this, you probably should in a nice way, but I think young ministers need to know. You don't have anything close to a thus saith the Lord in terms of the people in your church. Like, you saying it means very little. But if you can demonstrate something actually works, actually functions, then you start to build credibility and folks go, oh yeah, you know what? He is, she is wise beyond their years. Wisdom is proved in practice, not in speech. And so that's what, like, I wish I had known the Enneagram sooner, because I would have known better how to communicate with people who weren't giving me the benefit of the doubt based on knowledge.
So good. Sean, I want to let you know that you pull no punches. And I knew that this was going to be a good person to connect with when I read day one of the 40 days of being a three. Let me just read a little section to let you know why. Again, coming back to that motivation, right? And knowing the motivation behind what we do and why we do it is so important in ministry. And I think there's a lot of us young in ministry that are type threes. And I want to read this little section and just feel like if you get kicked in the gut like I did, it says this. It says, as an Enneagram three, the bear on my back every day is the temptation to be seen, to be heard, to be considered, to be worthwhile, as I show off in a show-off culture who gets rewarded for showing off. And the reward for showing off is more opportunities to show off. We call this success, but as a friend of mine asked, if a three succeeds and no one is there to see it, did it really happen? That was my first introduction to you. And I said, I need to dive in deep with this guy. And so over the next few days, reading this book, it just kept just speaking to me in so many deep levels that so many leadership books, you know, are kind of broad and they're just kind of, you know, hitting everybody. But what I love about, you know, the Enneagram, like you talked about, is it gets to those core motivations as to what we're doing and why we're doing it. And helping our volunteers even to know that and to understand themselves. And so in the book, Speaking by the Numbers, you talk about triads, you talk about stances. You want to just give kind of a working definition there as we dive into these?
Sure. I've talked a little bit about them already. So those are, and the good thing about the book is that it has diagrams. So you can see all of this. So triads, if you know the Enneagram, you've been introduced to triads. And so that's what I was talking about. Your triad. There are three of them, that's why I call them triads. Eights, nines, and ones. The body triad or the gut triad. And triads also determine which intelligence center you're done. So if you take intelligence centers, remember those three, thinking, feeling, and doing, there are three numbers that are dominant in each one of those. And eights, nines, and ones are dominant in the doing intelligence center. That's the gut triad. Twos, threes, and fours are in the feeling triad, the shame triad. So they are dominant in feeling. And then five, sixes, and sevens are in the thinking triad. So they are thinking dominant. Now, if you've seen the Enneagram diagram, you will note that 3, 6, and 9 are dominant and repressed in the same center. So let me talk about repressed. centers. We want to talk about that. That is the intelligence center that is repressed in you. And the ways that those shake out is that ones, twos, and sixes are repressed in the thinking center. They're called dependent stance. And some people call it reactive stance. Ones, twos, and sixes. That means that their instinct is to move toward others. So ones, twos, and sixes move towards others. Fours, fives, and nines are in the withdrawal phase. So that means they're doing repressed. So that means that they move away from others. Threes, sevens, and eights are in the aggressive stance, which means that they are feeling repressed, which means they move against. So, four, five, one, two, and six is dependent stance, four, fives, and nines, withdrawing stance, three, sevens, and eights, the aggressive or the assertive. So your triad names which intelligence center you're dominant in, and your stance, or what's also called a Grenadian group, named for a psychologist named Baron Harnay, your Grenadians determine which intelligence center you're repressed. So those are, you will notice, like I mentioned before, three, sixes, and nines and dominant in the same intelligence center. So threes are feeling dominant and feeling repressed, doing dominant and doing repressed. Sixes are thinking dominant and thinking repressed. Now, there's no way to talk about getting into the deep weeds of Enneagram theory. So that's why I made it. It's on page 36 of the book. It's hard to note without diagrams and being able to reference back and forth. So, but the means, like, I don't talk about the three. So what it means is, as a feeling dumb, I can walk into a room. I know what the room is feeling. I can sit down with the person. I can sense their feelings. But it means that I don't use feelings to maneuver into the world. So, and that same thing is true. It's about the productive use of that intelligence. Here's the beautiful thing. Because the intelligence center that you're dominant, because you decided, because it got wounded very early, you decided, hey, I'm not going to go there, I'm not going to use this, it didn't work. It's the most pure and pristine part of you. Because you shielded it your whole life. But it also means that it's the most immature part of you. Because you haven't used it your whole life. And so, if there's a child, it is in repressed thinking. And if we're going to receive or enter the kingdom as a child, that's where the gold is. Because that's the most childlike part.
So good. Now, there's a lot there, obviously. That's why there's a great book that I'd recommend, Speaking by the Numbers, to unpack all that even more. But you go through and you give some communication tips for each of those. And again, this is more than just preaching, right? I mean, this is vision casting, this is in written communication, this is all kind of stuff. So you want to just give us kind of, we're standing up in front of an audience, right? How do we kind of incorporate some of these communication tips into what we're doing?
Yeah, and like what I said in the book, is first of all, it's really helpful for you to know your number, right? So we talked about knowing your number. We talked about triads, where you're dominant intelligence center. We talked about stances. But there's more to it than there is. So what's called harmony, you know, harmonics, which is, answers the question, how do we cope? And that's a whole different level. So before you go on, you know, I see these things on TikTok and Instagram. People are talking about, you know, four driving a car, you know, a seven at the grocery store. And like, Ryan, like, they're all so stupid. And it really is just ignorance on parade. Because that's not how humans are structured. Like, we're all truly unique and different. And it's illustrative of someone who went to a weekend Enneagram workshop and then listened to some podcasts and thinks that they know what they're talking about. And so if you start to ask them, well, I don't want to get into it. But the key thing, first of all, is to know your number, because as I tell in the book, at the beginning of the book, the great danger when you're in a board meeting, you're with volunteers, you're with elders, you're with parents, you're with staff, is that you get up and you think the rest of the world perceives the world the same way that you do. And so in essence, you're just talking to yourself or the people in the room who do perceive the world as you do. Everybody else is going, how does it move? That doesn't make me want to give to this new venture or to sacrifice or the many things that churches invite their community into as ways of graces and deepening their spiritual discipline. So the first thing you have to do is you're structured, so you're not just talking to yourself. Then you have to actually listen to other people. Feedback. I'm a three, so I get it. Feedback for three is just, we love to get feedback. Even if it's negative feedback, because we tell ourselves, well, we'll make feedback. So we just want feedback. Some of that has to do with knowing what church you're in. Churches, too, typical churches, organized. And because that's the truth, your church probably has an Enneagram staff. So who are the leaders? Who are the founders? Who are the voices that do some things get done over and over and over? So I mentioned Chris C., who is a pastor. He's an eight on the Enneagram. So years ago, we were just sitting here in Asia Town in Houston, having dinner with him, talking to him about. And he said, you know what? Probably asking the church to do a lot. And everybody else at the table. Absolutely. Like, you have a new big venture every single week. You have people who said, I'm going to have to take a break. See, we're going to go to be a part of the break. And we ask them, because they receive those invitations and jump in. So as a communicator, as a leader, you need to know, what am I doing to people? Because of the way that my personality is structured, which doesn't mean that you're doing anything wrong. You might be doing what's wrong. So, and then, like, who are the other leaders around you? I've structured this team. What voices aren't being heard? When so-and-so asks their questions, are we a structure that suppresses those? Or when someone wants to start a new adventure, do we suppress that because they haven't answered all of our questions? Do we judge our worship gathering based on whether it was emotive? Or is there a smoke machine in the worship? Like, because it create, you know, you're creating a mood or something. Like, I don't, like some of us don't get that. I've been at places because of the way my personality is structured. I've spoken at places and walked into the middle of worship, and like, it's 100 degrees outside in the summer, but the worship leader got beanie on and smoke, and like light splitter, bean splitters on the lights. And like, for me, then I'm like, I don't even understand what this is. But I know that's a personality thing. But the people planning the worship need to know that there are people like me who won't be engaged that way, which is not an argument to do or not do it. There's a realization that we need to be aware of. And so that's going to be our steady diet. What else in our community can we offer people that would engage them, that speak certain way in the way that they perceive the world? So, to add to that, there are certain things with each person that if you do that certain thing to that person, you are likely to lose that person. Because there won't be a question of forgiveness. There won't be a question of whether or not they love you. If you strive to deeply way of seeing themselves, then that's going to cause a relational rift. And who wants to do that? If it can be avoided, you're gonna have enough of that over the course of your life. And you're so blessed if the two of you or the group of you can recover. You're going to do enough of that. So my advice was to never offend anyone. I'm trying to offend people on purpose. And as a pastor and preacher, I have to do that every so often. I don't want to do it. And I will, but I want to just narrow that to as minimal as it can.
Yeah, I think it's important, right? Because I think even as young leaders, I know for me, when I was first getting started, I kind of was winging it, you know, and it was like, hey, next weekend, let's go on a missions trip, right? And if people began to ask a lot of questions, it was kind of like, well, you're not bought into the vision. You don't believe that God's called us to go. And like you said earlier, you know, it's some of those deep thinkers or those that have questions about what if. They want to make sure that those are answered and that we've thought through those. Not because they're questioning us, but because they want to support us and they want to be able to back us, right? And so making sure that we value those voices, and if that's not a strength of yours, inviting those voices in to our communication, our prep time, and making sure and asking them, you know, hey, are we providing what you need? And I think you're right, you know, if we're not careful, we'll only present the gospel through the lens of how we perceive it, that, you know, like as a three, you know, we're going to talk about all God's rewards and how we, you know, and it's like, well, God does more than just that, right? And so providing a way that, you know, somebody who is another type can see the gospel and it's spoken to them, in a way that they can receive it as well, and making sure that we're working through that, which is tough, yeah. Right?
And that's one of the things I talk about in the last chapter of the book is exactly what you said, right? To write in community, it's very vulnerable for people who have very low ego strength. Ego strength is different from ego. So one of the practices, I'm doing this next week. So I just sketched out this morning an upcoming teaching series for the summer. And next week I will sit down in a room with people who won't ever say, we're on our staff, but won't ever say anything from our stage. Like, they won't ever. And they will help us shape those messages. If your orientation to the church is like, I'm large and in charge, whether it's in children's ministry or youth ministry, just give me a little diva, get to say what I wanted to say, and that trails on. Like, you'll be able to do that for a while and get away with it. And it's going to be so much richer when you begin to invite other people deliberately into that. Like, who needs, and the thing is, like, you don't have to ever do anything that they say. You have to follow them. I'm having something delivered apparently to the front door. So much. To hear those other voices say, oh, like, well, what about this? And what about that? I gained so much. I'm 48 years gained so much by 28 year olds and speaking to what I'm going to say. We have our first staff. We've been in staff for 6 months. And she's the first working in staff for the 2 months. And she has a lot of influence. She's 5 years removed from the age of my daughter, over 20 years removed from me. Being able to come from any of our perspective, from a gender perspective, from an age perspective, from married versus single, all of that really matters to me. And the more layered, the clearer and more focused teaching and messages can be.
And like you talked about, that takes a lot of emotional strength, just even confidence in our own leadership. So, which is tough, but it's great. And when you can begin to, I think it's easier to do that on the front end, right? Rather than on the back end. It's easier to do on the front end when we're preparing and inviting those people in to help us. Rather than on the back end, like you said, people got offended, they got hurt, they weren't spoken to, and so they start leaving. It's much easier to do on the front end and say, hey, we want to value those different voices. So, Sean, so great. Any last thoughts, or how can our listeners get a hold of you, kind of follow up with kind of what you're providing out there with resources?
Yeah, so the easiest way to find me is just at SeanIsaacPalmer.com. And then if folks just want to send an email, I do coaching both for speaking coaching and Enneagram. We also do church and business Enneagram coaching. So we work a lot with middle management and just to understand the teams. What we have found is whenever an organization has HR problems, what they were saying is they have personality problems. And we can help groups do that. It's being a team of people, years and years of Enneagram coaching and their toolbox. And so lots of ways, but that's the easiest. You can send me a message there, and I'd be glad to connect with anyone who's interested in going further. We're public speaking.
Yeah, so good. I want to encourage you guys to take a look at the 40 days of being, and then they've got all the different numbers. Want to encourage you guys also to check out the book Speaking by the Numbers. Just a great, great book in the tool belt as you're developing yourself as a communicator. And I want to thank you guys for listening to this episode of the Pastors Roundtable Podcast. I hope that it gave you some practical roadmaps to help you thrive in life and in leadership. Thank you guys so much, and look forward to sharing another episode with you here soon.